Robert Lee and Jack Lewis, you're both at Outpost 24 and using basically your unicorn scanner, you did some amazing discovery. First off, what is unicorn and what are we talking about?
Okay, well, unicorn scan was an attempt to make a user land TCP stack. We were originally using it to collect information from large networks that we were being paid to do penetration testing against. I'll let Jack briefly explain how that works. I guess we were doing a test and we just couldn't get the port scanning done in time. And so we decided to move the TCP stack into the program so we could make it distributed. And one of the problems you run into when you make a distributed stack is that the state of the stack has to be, I guess you could say, it has to be contained in some sort of way to where each machine doesn't have to track all the TCP connections, which is why we kind of had to take a strange approach by using the reverse SYN cookies or whatever you want so we could do the three-way handshake part without necessarily tracking the connection each step of the way. And so that's basically why or how we started noticing some funny things while scanning various networks. One of the things, too, that was important was Unicorn Scan was a really fast port scanner, too, which, of course, it would lead you to sometimes accidentally hit, like, network windows where the connectivity was bad. And so you would experience packet loss. And we didn't really have much code for determining if packet loss was happening. And so we, in the beginning at least, we would hit periods where we would just experience packet loss.
Wait, and so packet loss, basically, then you mean that the system runs into problems.
Yeah. And so we were noticing that certain specs, and I think we were mainly seeing it with routers, would randomly end up in strange states on the other side when there was packet loss. And I guess that's basically how we discovered it, because a lot of these stacks, we would hit certain states inside of their TCP where they basically would just never give up trying to talk back to us.
Yeah, they would retransmit certain packets over and over and over again.
Until the device was actually rebooted. You know, we didn't right away go into, I mean, we thought it was strange, you know, so we took note of it, but we didn't really look that much into it at first until I think a little bit later on when we were just curious about what we were actually doing to get these routers to never give up on trying to retransmit to us. I guess kind of as a joke, the first couple things that I tried, we made a program called SockStress that basically was very similar to Unicorn Scan, but instead of establishing or trying to do the right thing while establishing the TCP connection, it intentionally did some very evil things during the negotiation of the handshake. And that's basically what we came up with, our first version of SockStress that had two attacks in it. And I guess we were both surprised about how effective it was at first. I don't think either of us really had any idea that it would work so well.
Yeah, looking back on it, Jack, before he wrote the first attack, said, wouldn't it be funny if this worked? You know, said it kind of jokingly, and then he actually did it, and it was very effective.
Yeah, it worked really well. So,
okay, now you need to explain what works really well, because I understand what you do is something with the TCP/IP handshake, and the specifically the part that has been added because there is something called like a denial of service SYN flood attack.
Yeah, this is definitely not a SYN flood.
No, but you are messing with the part. What I understood, that has been added because there is something like a SYN flood attack.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take it back a step then. So back in 1985, there was a research paper written by Morris that talked about how you could spoof a connection attempt from a trusted host. And, you know, most people remember the paper for that side of it. But one of the interesting elements of the swoop attack that he describes is finding a working service on the host that you want to spoof and SYN flooding it, and to make it so that when you do send a SYN packet spoofed from its IP address and the SYN act comes back to it, it doesn't reset the connection for you. So that was back in 85 that we knew about SYN flooding, which basically is the idea of a premise that a system with a listening TCP service has only a finite amount of resources. So let's say, hypothetically, that the system can only accept 1,000 concurrent connections from different clients that are out there. The way a SYN attack works, a SYN flooding attack, is the attacker simply sends enough SYN packets to take up all those slots or all those resources on the server side to make it so that no legitimate connection attempt has a chance to actually complete the connection. So in 1996, a number of different programs and articles were written about the SYN flood attacks, and so it became very popular. At the tail end of 96, researcher Bernstein came up with the concept of SYN cookies. And what SYN cookies basically does is it offloads, it basically makes it so that instead of taking up all those resources at the time that the initial synchronous packet is received, it can take all the session details or the metadata for that session connection attempt and put that into a hash table. And take a lookup entry for that hash table and use that as a sequence number for its response to the synchronization attempt. And that way the attacker now has to acknowledge this special token, this sequence number, in a valid format in order to complete the three-way handshake. And so this basically makes it so two things happen. Number one, the attacker now has to actually see the response packet to his SYN. And he also can no longer be doing this from a spoofed location because the response packets have to be at a network that's accessible to him. So now we're caught up to 1996. What happened shortly after that, from our research, as soon as 1999, maybe even sooner by other researchers who didn't really publish their works, but some researchers figured out that you could, in a client program, implement your own idea of client-side SYN cookies, where basically you encode something into your initial sequence number so that when the server responds to you, you can quickly tell if it's a response to something that you generated. Okay, so I'll go let Jack take over again.
But, I mean, that's one of the original features. I mean, going back, that was one of the original design goals of the Unicorn Scan, would be to use the SYN cookies so that we don't have to actually have a session table at all. So that we know it. Basically, what we're doing is we take we know the IP address of what we call the sender, and we know what local source port we're sending the packet from, obviously. And then we apply a hash function to that and put that as the initial sequence number. If the packet comes back with that number reflected in the SYNAC, then we know we had sent it. So that's an important thing to realize, because at no point during that, I mean, if you're going to win a resource war, this is where it becomes more important. If you're going to win a resource war with a remote system, if you have to track all the sessions that you're using to attack the other system, obviously you're at a disadvantage against someone who doesn't actually need to track any of its sessions, but the other side does. Obviously, who's ever tracking the resources will run out of resources first. And so that's one of the techniques that allows this attack to be so efficient, because we can, if we want to, we can establish thousands of concurrent connections, and it makes no difference to us. But if the other system has to track it, obviously they're at a much bigger disadvantage. I can't say specifically the exact attacks that we have, but I can say that using reverse SYN cookies allows us to encode information
about the session inside the cookie in the TCP packet to allow us to do attacks without ever keeping track of state of anything. So the packets going back and forth basically carry the information about the attack, and I guess you could say what phase it's in. So that's an important part. So.
Yeah.
And now what I understand is what the attacks do is basically what we would call a denial of service attack, so bring the system to its knees.
It just depends. So in one of the examples that we'll be showing at the TQ conference in Finland, we are interacting with a TCP-based service, and we're making it so that service itself no longer is available. Now, from the server side, if you're a systems administrator trying to troubleshoot the environment, you would probably get a phone call from customers saying that they can't reach your web server anymore. But what will feel weird to you is if you look at uptime, if you look at any like TOP or any other sysadmin program, your CPU looks normal, your memory consumption looks normal. If you look at your network availability, you're able to communicate with other hosts just fine. There's no seeming other difficulties or problems for the system at all, other than people can't connect to the specific resource that's under attack. And that's using the simple versions of the attack. There are a couple other attacks that Jack has created that are cascading into other more vulnerable parts of the kernel, which can actually cause a large amount of system memory to be used. And at that point, once you start running out of system memory and swap space, the kernel, depending on the implementation again, could even start randomly killing processes or reboot the system or in some other way get into a defunct state where the entire system is hosed. But that is not necessarily the goal of the attacker. The primary attack goal is to take a TCP service that's available and make it unavailable.
Yes, but now you're saying that, okay, that's just one of the scenarios. We've got multiple of them. Are we talking about multiple issues then?
Yes. There's a couple important points to consider. Again, not telling all the details about the individual attacks does make it a bit hard to understand. But bear with me for a second. I mean, what you have to understand, I guess, to kind of visualize the severity of these attacks is that each TCP stack has a set or it has resources for it to use to do TCP. That's pretty obvious. It has timers inside the kernel so that the kernel can remember to do things at certain time. It has memory set aside, in some cases multiple different types of memory set aside for various parts of that TCP stack to use. There's all sorts of resources that TCP stack has. Now, depending on how you establish a connection with the kernel, and then what you do while establishing that session in the kernel, you can pinpoint which resources you're going to exhaust by creating certain scenarios. So let's say you establish a connection to someone, and this is just an example, this isn't real, but just to illustrate the point, let's say you start pretending like you're experiencing lots of packet loss while you negotiate that connection. Well, let's say that the kernel now has to put some timers to remind itself, hey, this guy in a couple minutes needs to restart this transmit timer because he's experiencing packet loss, so we're going to slow down, we're going to wait a little bit, and then in a little bit we'll start transmitting again because he's having network issues. Okay, so let's say you do that 1,000 times in a row. You might not do the obvious thing of exhausting all the memory, but what you might run out of are timers. And if that kernel runs out of those timers, it might be sharing those timers with other things inside the kernel, too. In that scenario, if this maybe, I guess you could say, badly designed TCP stack just used up all that kind of timers inside the kernel, then any subsystem that also uses those timers is now going to have serious issues functioning. And what's important to note, of course, is that this is a very low bandwidth attack.
Wait, low bandwidth?
To say it simply, we can basically perform most of these attacks on large websites from a cable modem without any issues. we don't need a large network connection.
Yeah. So as we were talking about before, it's a resource game. So we're saying from under 40 packets per second, we could probably take off most TCP services that we interact with.
And each operating system does behave differently, of course. You might notice that OS X, perhaps there's a couple attacks that don't seem to bother it too much, but completely devastate Windows XP, and of course the other way around. There are a lot of variables. Each stack has a different set of resources. In fact, the user can tune his or her machine so that it has more or less of certain resources. But the point is that these resources are almost always trivial to exhaust. For example, we wrote an attack. I was reading the Linux source code, and I noticed in the comments, one of the comments, the author said, well, we don't want to ever end up in this state, specifically because this and this and this would happen. So we have to actively try and get out of this state. So, of course, the first thing I did is I went in and set up a series of packets that would cause it to get in exactly that state, just like the comments said they were trying to avoid. And that attack was incredibly effective against Linux, but then we turned around and used it on a Windows machine, and it completely hard-locked up the machine, too, and so we're surprised. But maybe on a small embedded device, it wouldn't have the same effect. It's a toss-up. There's a whole set of issues. But the idea is that TCP is basically, it assumes once you go through the three-way handshake, you're a pretty decent individual. You're not spoofing. So we can start using a whole bunch of resources once we get through that three-way handshake. But the actual issue is once you perform the three-way handshake, doesn't get guarantee at all that the other guy is not attacking you. And so there's a lot of resources that are exposed just by having a TCP service listening that an attacker can very easily just take offline because programs, they are so easy. They so easy. Or
they want to trust. Well, yeah. Once you've proven that you are not spoofing, then the protection of the send cookie, the server-side send cookie, is bypassed. And it assumes that you're a trustworthy individual. It assumes that when you ask for resources, that it should give them to you.
Yeah. So I mean, the point is.
So if I understand this correctly, just let me rephrase it. Because that check has been added, the handshake, and if the handshake is okay, the system thinks that you're safe. And at that point, basically, that's where your attack only starts.
Right.
And then you can do the most not-so-funny things like rebooting a system, processes that can fail, or even worse, like a total denial of service of the TCP/IP stack.
Yeah, that's correct. I think the worst thing we ever had happen was we had Windows reboot and say operating system not found. That was by far the worst effect we've ever seen. And what's important too to notice is when you mess with things like timers, sometimes after the attack is over, the system never really seems to recover until it's rebooted. So there's like a tipping point that you hit. I mean, the system is slowly being exhausted of resources, and then, and I can say for, this is most notable with Windows, after you hit a certain threshold, the system just is no longer functional, and it's very drastic, and stopping the attack has basically almost no effect whatsoever. The machine needs to be rebooted in order to be fixed. So, I mean, it does draw some scary ideas in your head, like let's say you have an open wireless and someone drives by, performs an attack on some big Windows server, and the server starts to hit this threshold and then it's no longer responsive and then that guy just drives away. Now, how are you going to find him? I mean, those kind of attacks are obviously always the worst when they require you to reboot the system for it to become functional again.
So that means that basically anyone that owns a computer or a cell phone could do this attack if they understand how?
I wouldn't say a cell phone, because the cell phone networks aren't very good. But
like an iPhone or any...
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, the whole design of the tool is to use the least amount of resources possible.
How many packets do I need to start, you know, until another system starts to notice that something is wrong? How many packets?
If you just want to take, like, a web server offline, you can usually do it in seconds. It's really easy to do.
And then you never recover.
There's multiple attacks and there's multiple operating systems. And so if you mix and match these things, you can't always guarantee that something will be permanently offline without knowing which side the other guy is.
To answer the first question, you can get it to the point where the service is no longer responsive to new connection attempts with a very low packet per second in a very short time.
I mean, we're talking around like 10 packets per second can shut down one service. That's really easy to do. But
in minutes, you can take down an entire data center.
In theory, yeah. We've never done that, obviously. We've done testing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the scale of our testing thus far has really been like one versus one. Let's try and scientifically figure out what impacts the system the most. So how practical it is, think about all those bot networks out there that kids use the DDoS things. Now, if those guys were to actually adopt some of these attacks, they may as well have a DOS network that's 100 times bigger, because these attacks are, probably a lot more than 100 times more effective at DOSing people. So, yeah, it certainly would be easy.
I feel kind of reluctant to ask this question, but are there any systems non-vulnerable?
We have not encountered anything that is not vulnerable yet. Every system that we've tried our attacks against has been vulnerable.
That's not good news.
No.
Well,
to further complicate things, we've been in contact with the Computer Emergency Response Team out of Finland, who've been doing a multi-vendor coordination effort with a number of vendors. I won't name names right now, but as of right now, there is no workaround or fix available either.
Again, stop. There is no workaround or fix.
Correct.
Not that we know.
This is why we had to agree, to be totally honest to the listener, this is why we had to agree that we wouldn't share any real technical details on how to do it yet. But if there is no solution, why do you bring it in the open? Why are we talking about this?
Well, this discovery was initially made in 2005. And back then, we had reservations about coming public with it because there was also no information available on how to solve it. So the hope is now that we are coming forward and pointing out that there is an issue, that we can raise the awareness and get more people that are smarter than we are involved in looking at a solution. Because just because we can't think of a solution doesn't mean there isn't one. It just means that we haven't thought of it yet. And we're also seeing signs that with the adoption of IP version 6, that these sorts of problems based on our implementation of the attack is actually going to be made worse. If someone doesn't stand up and wave their hand and go, we have an issue here, guys, these things that we've been putting online are pretty easy to knock over. Just because we never talk about that publicly, it certainly won't get any better. And when we adopt things like IP version 6, the problem is it's three times worse, at least. And there's so many new features going in, and it just doesn't seem like people are thinking about what are the impacts of adding all this new neat functionality. Attacks are becoming worse and worse. And so if we don't say anything, if we don't, like, raise our hand and try and tell vendors that they have an issue, in 5 years when we're using more complicated stacks that have more code in them and someone figures this out, then we're going to be really screwed. So, I mean, the solution, of course, is to not just, wipe it under the rug and just pretend that there's no problem. I mean, it certainly will only get worse from this point forward unless people start thinking about this kind of stuff.
Okay. And how did Fendos respond?
we're still waiting for some more positive response. I think that they're still trying to understand all the different implications for their environments. But yeah, to be determined. We haven't had satisfactory response as of yet.
Okay, and you gave me a couple of days of heads up, so I found, for instance, the FreeBSD SYN cookie brute forcing attack that was dated back in 2003. Isn't that the same issue? I mean, hasn't BSD solved this?
Not really. No. Like we were saying before, a lot of people have done client side SYN cookies in the past, but that is not the attack. The attack is what happens after we complete that three-way handshake. How we complete the three-way handshake is interesting and notable, but it's not the attack at all.
Okay. Robert, you were aware of my hesitation at first, because bringing this out in the open, only showing the direction of where to look, might bring people to an idea how to recreate this attack, especially if they've got your software, which is open source.
The unicorn scan portion.
Yes.
But the attacks obviously aren't open source.
No. But, you know, they could figure that out. We saw that with Dan Kaminsky happening. So you are taking a risk.
Well, the thing is we also are taking a risk that some really smart guy is going to tell us there's some really smart workaround for this that we didn't know. I mean, of course it can go, there could be bad or good things that have come from it, but I think that the only possible outcome, I think that by trying to talk to people and point out that there's problems with certain things, especially when we're not giving out the details and we're not telling them, hey, do this and that system will fall over. We're not doing that. I think the best thing that will happen is that people are just going to kind of start to poke around and think and go, okay, maybe there's actually some ways to fix this. And it's foolish to think that just because we maybe don't tell someone about how these attacks work, someone else will eventually find out anyway that these attacks do work. We don't have to tell them. It is a matter of time before someone else finds out.
Yeah, we certainly don't have a monopoly on intelligence or bug-finding abilities. So
it's not one of those things. I mean, eventually someone would have found a problem in DNS, too. It's just a matter of time. Like, maybe someone found it 3 years ago. We don't really know. But a coordinated, responsible disclosure and trying to bring awareness that there are security implications that involve TCP, I think, are only going to be beneficial for everyone on the Internet. I certainly don't want the Internet to fall over, and I certainly want people to take TCP and availability more seriously than they do now. I think what we're doing is the best thing we can do.
Having said that, then basically still we can draw the inference. At this point, TCP IP, as we know it, is broken beyond repair, as far as we know.
Yeah, certainly the implementations that we've played with.
And that's basically Linux, BSD, Windows, probably all the routers that are out there.
Yeah.
Is there a way to mitigate the risk, for instance, by installing a firewall or by using a intrusion prevention system? Or would that make it worse?
What's interesting about that is, especially in the case where this inline device is a final point for lots of systems behind it, its stack is now having to do the work of all the machines that it's in front of. And so it will feel the effects of this attack that much faster. So if it's in front of 32 systems, I mean, it's almost a 32 times more effective against a firewall.
Why do we say 32 times more effective? Why this number?
Because there's 32 machines that it's keeping track of. It's trying to do the work of 32 TCP stacks. And so if you were to simultaneously attack all these IP addresses at the same time, they would all end up attacking this one machine and the machines in back of it, depending. And so, yeah, it does, every time you duplicate code, basically, you increase your exposure. Having an IPS sitting in front of a machine that has a TCP IP stack, you have two times as much code. And a lot of the times, for whatever reason, it seems like the IPSs aren't designed to deal with denial of service.
well, the stack that you have on your computer has been out on the internet for a while, and people have taken it a lot more seriously to make, for example, the Windows TCP/IP stack and the BSD TCP/IP stack have been hardened against denial of service because it's been so prevalent. But it seems like a lot of security devices that sit in line don't really stand up to the same scrutiny over the years.
Yeah.
So those usually are pretty easy to do a DOS compared to, let's say, a kernel stack. It's just that much easier. And I wish I could tell you why, but I think that security people, when they develop a security product, and it, especially when it's a network security product, and then they just think, oh, it's a security product. But a lot of the times, those have security vulnerabilities, too. I mean, we see it all the time where the antivirus products, you know, have buffer overflows in them and stuff like that. You might be able to get a virus by scanning for viruses because you have a vulnerability in your antivirus scanner. That stuff happens now. But a long time ago, people would think you were crazy for saying, oh, well, what about your antivirus? It could be dangerous running it, and people would laugh at you. But now you're starting to see practical attacks of that, too. So it's just the same thing. It's the same pattern, and it's just going to happen again.
And don't even bother moving to IPv6 because that makes it worse, you say. So why is that?
IP version 6 inherently uses more resources than IP version 4 does. The address space is much bigger. There's a lot more features that IP version 6 has. That's a lot more resources that are exposed. It's the same reason. Just there's so much more functionality inside there now and so much more memory usage that it's that much easier to do a denial of service attack on. And it's not like they rewrote TCP for IP version 6.
Okay. One technical question that I've left. When I start this attack, I don't need to let the connection stand, do I? I just can show up, do my attack, and then basically leave again, right?
It depends on which attack that you're doing. The attacks that we were talking about before that are the lowest bandwidth, lowest resource on the attacker side that simply make the TCP service unavailable. In most cases, not all, but in most cases, the effects of the attack are only sustained as long as the attack is sustained.
But the more exotic attacks where we actually cause the machine to, like, let's say, run out of resources like timers, those will persist after the attack stops. So it depends on what resource you're attacking, basically, is the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said you had multiple attack scenarios. How many have you got so far?
I think total I have 5 documented. But it certainly isn't hard to come up with new ones. You basically have to sit there and stare through code and figure out what sorts of, at what stages that you can get to, given these constraints, would use the most amount of resources. And
depending on how complicated the actual stack implementation is on the system that you're targeting, there could be, in theory, between, you know, 5 and maybe even upwards of 30 additional attack types that could be discovered. But Jack has documented 5 so far.
Okay, and all of them need a different fix, or would one fix it all?
Well, since we don't know what the fix is, it's really hard to answer that question, of course. If we were to come up with a way that we think mitigates this the best, if we apply that philosophy to all the things inside the TCP/IP stack and just kind of go through and review, that's what we would reuse. It's not like we could just fix this one line of code and the problem would magically go away. We would have to go through a lot of code and just audit all the different resources that could be deployed inside of TCP that we need to protect better. And that's how we would solve the problem. It's not like we're just going to patch one line of code and fix it.
Okay, what would you like to see the TCP/IP and security community do with the knowledge that we're sharing today?
I'd like to get some really smart people to think about what sorts of things are available in TCP and how we could potentially safeguard our kernels a little bit better against people who are malicious. And I really want people to consider, just because we're not spoofing our source address, we certainly can still be malicious. There's so many features inside TCP, and people really don't consider the implications of using various features, and they really should. And that's what I'd like people to think about. So someone who's really smart could come up with a really intelligent way to protect your systems.
Yes. Given the bug that Dan Kaminsky found in DNS, given that the BGP issue, given your issue now, do you see much future for TCP as we know it, or is it time to totally rethink the protocol?
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk about this internally all the time. There's a lot of researchers out there that will go find a major bug and pull a chicken little routine about how, oh, we could break the Internet in 30 seconds and, you know, it's doomsday all over again. And although we do definitely take this seriously, we do think this is a very highly severe availability issue. We think that the community is smart enough and proven robust enough to be able to handle these sorts of things before it becomes too bad of an issue. So I think every time that we've thought a system is so bad that we have to just scrap it and throw the baby out with the bathwater, I am often surprised at how simple and elegant a solution that we didn't think about can be. So I'm hoping that's what happens in this case as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, we still use SMTP to send email. And the majority of the email on the Internet is spam. But do we throw out SMTP because it was a broken design? I mean, the community as a whole, I think, likes to find workarounds more than anything else. I mean, if it was a perfect world, we probably should reconsider how we do TCP. And we should probably consider that people on the Internet aren't happy and want us to do the best. But
it's a hostile environment.
It's actually more of a hostile environment than a lot of the people who are designing these protocols thought. So ideally, we probably should design something new, but chances are pretty slim that that'll ever happen. I think that someone will just come around with some mitigations that really limit the depth of this problem, something that everyone's willing to accept. I think that's probably what will happen.
Okay. Well, Jacques-Louis and Robert Lee, thank you so much for breaking the Internet, I would be inclined to say.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking time with us.
Ja, en daarmee komt een einde aan deze derde beveiligingsupdate. Mijn naam is Brenno de Winter. Reacties kunt u kwijt op de website onder het artikel over deze podcast, www.debeveiligingsupdate.nl. U kunt natuurlijk ook mailen met tips, nieuwe feiten, kritiek, feedback, wat het ook allemaal meer mag zijn. redactie@debeveiligingsupdate.nl. En dan rest mij u nog te bedanken voor het luisteren en graag tot volgende week. En hou het ondertussen allemaal veilig. Mocht ondertussen iets gebeuren, dan zijn wij er natuurlijk altijd weer met een special. Dit programma wordt mede mogelijk gemaakt door Fox IT. Fox IT maakt bijzondere security en intelligence oplossingen voor overheden en maatschappelijk belangrijke organisaties.